Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mix engineer Gary Lux. First of all, do artists really want to stay independent? Well, the promise of crypto and NFTs and Web3 is to eliminate the middleman, and the middleman is always who gets the most money. Artists have been fed up with it for a long time. The promise now says there's no need for a record label and there's no need for management. You could all do it yourself, or at the very least, you can reduce the reliance that you have on the middleman. Artists have always at least partially hated record labels and publishers, so this might seem like a good idea. If you look at it closely, though, you'll find that most of these promises are coming from the tech industry and not so much from the music community. Most musicians and actors and writers and filmmakers and creative people in general really do prefer the support of an institution that has expertise. It just makes their life easier. It's easier to get money to create. It's easier to get support to create. It's easier to not think about marketing, for instance, or sales. Now, if you want proof of this, even artists that have majorly big, deep pockets like Taylor Swift or Adele or Jay-Z, well, guess what? They're signed to major record labels. They're not doing it themselves. Good managers and labels know how to help artists, and they have the infrastructure that's really difficult to duplicate. And in the end, most artists would just rather create instead of having to do the business. Artists have more power and they have better deals than they've ever had before. When you're starting today as an artist, you sort of have to be a jack of all trades, but that doesn't mean you're good at everything. And even if you do get good at one thing, it doesn't mean that you have all the skills that you need to grow a career. So don't buy into the fact that crypto and NFTs and Web3 is going to really substantially change the way artists do business. Yes, it's going to help them. Yes, it's going to contribute. But in the end, artists really do want a collaboration with some experts that can do business better than they can. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, learn about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. Now, the musical instrument part of the industry is going through a major revolution, but it might not be that apparent. In the past, we've had really big product innovations. The Hammond organ, for instance, was one of the first instruments to take advantage of electricity and turn it into music. Leo Fender was responsible for mass-producing guitars. The drum machine changed the way we thought about how music was put together and how drummers, and all musicians for that matter, would play to the beat. Then we had software that rendered tape machines obsolete. So product innovations led the musical instrument industry. We're not really ready to say the product innovation has reached its endpoint, but it really has slowed lately. Everything today is more of an evolution rather than an innovation, and if you go to a NAMM show, you'll see that right away, as things haven't changed all that much from year to year for quite a long time. The revolution that we're undergoing is mostly unseen. Sales and distribution represented one of the biggest costs in any musical product, typically accounting for somewhere between 35% and 40% of the retail selling price. But now we have online retailers like Sweetwater and Amazon that have changed that equation. We have targeted marketing with low overhead and way lower costs. Niche product that wouldn't have a chance previously, like what you find downstairs in the lower levels of the NAMM show. They never would have had a chance previously, but now, if you have a compelling demonstration video, you can micro-target to potential buyers in social media, so a manufacturer can quickly and cheaply get the word out, even on the most specialized products. Brick-and-mortar retailers now even use Amazon and Reverb to sell products to a much wider audience than they have locally. This revolution is more about marketing than it is about product. My guest this week is Gary Lux, who's one of Hollywood's premier music mixers with literally thousands of projects to his credit. Before stepping out on his own, Gary was the head music mixer for Universal Studios, where he earned 2 Emmy Award nominations for his work with the Jacksons and Frank Sinatra. He has a wide range of music mixing credits, including Usher, Sting, Rob Thomas, Britney Spears, Norah Jones, No Doubt, and many more. Gary was also one of the first to delve into 5.1 surround mixing and has now mixed hundreds of titles in Dolby Atmos. During the interview, we spoke about dealing with stereo stems and immersive mixing, mixing for the headphone experience, mixing Van Halen in Atmos, his approach to mastering immersive material, and much more. I spoke with Gary and his studio partner Dominic via Zoom from a studio near Los Angeles. I want to talk to you specifically about Atmos because there's lots and lots of questions and you have lots and lots of experience. Again, you have experience. It goes back to sort of the beginning of surround sound. When was the first Atmos mix that you did?
So, you know, I had been dabbling in Atmos, but Russ at RSPE always wanted me to get an Atmos system. And I didn't really want to get one because I didn't really see a business model. I'm not a re-recording mixer and I didn't, you know, I'm not mixing film, you know, as it were, like that. And so, but my partner, Dave Donnelly, and I had been nurturing the major labels during the pandemic and even before then, just discussing where immersive, you know, was going. And so, you know, in order to have this capital expense with all of this gear and speakers and stuff, you have to have a business model, you know. So we were talking to the major labels and we were setting ourselves up. I sent a couple of mixes in and they approved it. And so we were on our way. And actually, while I was building the studio here, I was mixing at RSPE. They have a room there. And so while we were building this, we were doing the mixes there. So this is probably, you know, May of 21. We did a lot of stuff. Then we did J-Lo single and, you know, pretty much up to this point over the last 6 months, we've probably mixed over 200 songs. So, but it's, you know, it's really interesting how the business comes to us through the record labels, through Universal, through Sony, through Roc Nation, through Rhino, you know, all of the labels that Dave has had relationships with, you know, through the years. And with my experience in 5.1 and surround, we became a good team and, you know, it's working out great. So, you know, we're very thankful for this. This newfound workflow.
Did you find the transition from 5.1 to Atmos immersive? How did you find that? Was it easy? Was it hard? Was it hard to get your arms around?
So, you know, I mixed so much stuff in 5.1. And in my mind, you know, I always felt that if there were more speakers above me, I even in 5.1, I always treated the front and the back. I always thought in my mind that I was doming, that I always made this kind of a pattern going, you know, up like a doming type of thing, which now, of course, with the ceiling speakers, you know, we're able to achieve. So it really easy from a mixing standpoint, but difficult from a delivery standpoint. Atmos is a very difficult format to perceive, to make it work, to deliver. And, you know, luckily I have, you know, a monster expert here with my partner over here who's, you know, takes care of all that stuff.
It's interesting in that we're going from stereo to 5.1 after all the gear came out. It wasn't that difficult to get your arms around. But Atmos is different because there's a lot more going on and there's a lot more under the hood that most people are not familiar with. It takes some time to get used to.
Yeah, it does. I mean, again, you know, people just think that if you just put stuff all over the speakers, You'll have a great Atmos mix. But you know, Bobby, that in music, instruments and voices need to relate to each other. So there is a point when they can be too far apart. And, you know, you got a big hole in the mix. So, you know, guitars still need to be together. Vocals still need to be together. And, you know, so it's very subjective.
Do you find that your mixing approach is different in terms of the way you think about it from 5.1?
No, not really, because, you know, when we get multi-tracks and everything is in a, on a, you know, a mono track, you know, that's when this format is really groovy. That's when 5.1 was, you know, really groovy, when you had discrete mono tracks that you were able to place all over the place, you know, without it having a stereo, you know, stem type of thing where it had a baked in, you know, reverbs and stuff. So again, you know, people ask me, you know, what happens in the best mixes in 5.1 and surround is mono discrete is the best for placing things all over. So I approach it the same. I you know, there's a lot more to the Atmos, and it sounds better because it you know, where you place something in the spectrum here, it'll always be there, you know, when you come back. You know, it's not like you're sharing two speakers, then it has to be phantom center between the right front and the right rear. There's a lot of speakers in between to guarantee the placement that you really wanted.
You know, I just mentioned stereo tracks. How do you deal with that?
So, you know, we do get a lot of stuff that has stereo stems. So basically what these are theoretically is you take all the stems, you put them up to zero, and it equals the stereo mix. Not quite. So what happens is when you do have the stereo stems, you're really not, it's difficult to take them and pinch them inside the field. You have to kind of stay wide with these things because, you know, if you have a vocal and it's got some effects on it, if you start moving it in to create like a little bit of a center, it'll just start phasing and it doesn't sound right. So it's, for a lot of stuff that we do, a lot, it's left, right, but height and back and, you know, but trying to pinch these stereo stems like towards the center doesn't work.
How about the gear that you've invested in? Because it's not a small investment at all. And now I think we're finally getting to the point where there's packages coming out of speakers and everything, but it wasn't, and probably when you started, it wasn't like that. You're limited in choices, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I have the, you know, a terrific PMC system that I got from RSPE, and I just got the new left, center, right. I got the new sixes that they got, the single six. And I have two sixes in the back, and, you know, the wafers all the way around and two 10-inch subs. It sounds, you know, terrific in this room. So it was it's expensive, you know, and again, you know, like anything in business, you can't, like, if you build it, they will come. You know, you have to have a business model in this, or you'll find yourself with a lot of speakers in the room and not much going on. So I waited a really long time before the floodgates opened and we made the investment.
It's funny you should mention, because there's a lot of Atmos facilities opening up, and I scratch my head thinking, where's all this work? You were plugged in already to the record labels, so you can get it there, but I think what you say is true. Some people are just opening up a studio and saying, okay, I got it, come and work with me.
It's always tough when people do something for a knee-jerk reaction in business and anything else. And I keep saying this, I tell Dominic all the time, I tell everybody, I tell the world, this is a gift that's come back to me. You know, I was one of the original pioneers in 5.1, and then it went away. But because Apple has, you know, mandated that they want spatial audio music, we're back. So I'm very grateful, and it's fun to do, and I've had a lot of experience.
Now, speaking of Apple, there's a fair amount of consumer distribution possibilities, and I wonder how many people are listening to just headphones as compared to, you know, a discrete speaker system.
Well, you want to talk to that?
I mean, you know, I think the the hardest part is that, you know, Gary always says, you know, there's 30 people with this room, you know, but there's 6 billion people with headphones. And the experience that Atmos gives, you know, as Apple continues to update and perfect spatial audio, it's, you know, ever evolving, and, you know, getting down to head tracking and the experience of it. I mean, to be honest, the fidelity is, it's unreal. And, you know, it's more fun. I mean, when you just put music in context of, obviously, you know, the quality of the work itself is important, but in terms of the experience, it's just fun. And I think Apple released, what, 2 weeks ago or so, you know, that spatial audio was the smash hit that really helped their, you know, numbers in streaming and all this stuff. And it comes down to the experience and being able to experience music in a new way that brings a new life to old songs from 10 years ago or 15 years ago or even 20, and, you know, some of the classics of the 70s and 80s that are getting kind of rebirthed, you know, getting to hear, you know, friends and colleagues and, you know, consumers talk about their excitement and how they got to relive this song and, you know, speak to it is I think an important aspect of what it's done for music again.
You know, Bobby, you know, people have been chasing repurposing music forever. We're going to remaster it. We're going to do this. We're going to do this. But this is really something, you know, we all know Apple wants to sell headphones, and we're very cognizant of the fact that even though, you know, I've got 15 speakers in this room, that we're reducing this for the consumer to have the best experience. And when we do check our binaural headphones and we do check the headphone reduction of things, you know, if we feel that something is too bright, too loud, or something based on the headphone, we'll go back and change it, because that's really our job, is to, you know, I may hear it differently in the speakers, but because of the, you know, the rendering that's going on, a high frequency that I may have put in the back is a little too bright, it's a little too prominent, whatever. So we'll deal with it from the consumer standpoint, because that's where it's got to go.
You know, and speaking of spatial audio and Apple, it's not only music, but it's other program as well. I was sitting in the dentist's office the other day with my Apple headphones on, and I was listening to talk radio, and I turned my head, and
it's moving.
Yeah. And you know, the person talking was over here, and it was like, oh, what happened there? You turn your head down, he's up here.
Yeah. Well, probably the most, you know, besides that gyroscoping type of thing, the fact that we're in, you know, 2448, you know, we start off, we're done with MP3s, we're done with 16-bit 44.1, that's gone. So, you know, the fact that we're at 2448, you know, gives the listener a really good chance of what it sounded like when it left our hands.
Let's talk about the tools that you're using. What are you using for monitoring?
So I do have the PMC system.
But the monitor controller, I'm sorry.
Oh, the monitor controller. I've got a, you know, I got the S6. I mean, S6. I have two S1s. I had the S6. I have two S1s and a dock. And it's really fantastic. It's sort of, you know, it's easy to use. And, you know, gets us, you know, where we need to be. You know, so much stuff is done inside the editing pages now, you know, with clip gain and stuff. It's not so important for us these days to have the Penny and Giles faders, and because we just don't make those radical type of moves anymore. We're much more in a, you know, just a, you know, just, you know, slight moves on the faders, because we do so much in clip gain, you know, before we get to it. So, yeah. And then, you know, a bunch of iPads, you know, it's, we love it. And it's very simple to use. And it's mostly really more of what we need, as opposed to 90% of the console that we wouldn't use to begin with.
It's a lot better than the early days of 5.1, where there was no way to actually change the level of all the speakers at once. You had to kludge it together.
No, we had to really mix it going in.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. What are you using in terms of plugins?
So, you know, I mean, I have just the same plugins as everybody else has. I sort of really love the Massenburg, MDW. That thing is fantastic. I use the Axe. What is it?
The Waves Axe.
It's you know, it's probably as old as I am, but you know, there are just some things that just work, you know, all the time. an Inflator and the Gullfoss, you know, those type of things. You know, we do get a lot. We get a lot of the stuff that's has the effects that are already baked in. So most of the job in Atmos is to clear it up, you know, make things, you know, to take out some mid range, you know, add some of the clarity, because in a stereo mix, things some to the middle. Once we start pulling things apart, you get a little bit more clarity in the EQ section. So we brighten things up a little bit, and it's a little bit of a different animal because, you know, because of the subs, you know.
I've talked to other mixers and mastering engineers, and everybody said, okay, when we started to do this, there was no call to make things louder, and all of a sudden, it's starting again. Are you finding that where people want louder mixes? And I know that you can't go beyond minus 18, but you can
still
that's
right.
It.
And I think that is the best part of this format, is that we're all in it. Minus 18 is it. And there's, you know, we're just not mixing. We're not doing level for hysteria. It's very, a lot of dynamic range. And so I think that's a great thing, you know.
I think one of the difficulties is dealing with the clients on the other end. When we first started, you know, on the review and approval side, you know, a lot of the labels don't have rooms readily available for artists to get into. So, you know, we're sending binaurals and now MP4s as, you know, more Apple headphones, Pros and Maxes are being used. And one of the things we dealt with early on was the loudness. You know, most artists are used to seeing that bar at a certain volume and knowing what that means to the mix. And, you know, it's all the way up for them and it's still not, you know, to that level. So kind of walking through what it means, how it's going to end up on Apple, because, you know, when you have, I think it's called sound check enabled, it'll kind of balance everything out so you can get that headroom back. But kind of just explaining that process, you know, that a Dolby master doesn't mean that it's, you know, slammed to all heck and back. So there's a little bit of difficulty there. But I think, you know, as we're moving forward, you know, the best thing is obviously being able to turn it up in a room.
Okay, well, that leads to a question then. Since you're coming in after the fact most of the time, the stereo mix has been done. And obviously everybody signed off on the stereo mix. But it's really hard to make it sound the same, and just in terms of its vibe. I'm not saying it's better or worse. It's just maybe somebody is so married to the stereo mix and they're going, well, it doesn't have this glue. It doesn't have, you know, whatever it might be. Are you running into anything like that?
Again, part of the gift is that these things have been signed off on. I'm not flying things around in the room just for the sake of making, you know, Star Wars here. It still has to be congruous with the mix. It has to make sense. I believe a good static mix with some things that are pulsating and moving, you know, constantly is a nice thing. And if effect needs to be, you know, left or right or whatever, then, you know, so be it. It's a fun thing to do, and we're enjoying it. And again, it's the gift of my career.
A few months ago, I saw somewhere, and then we had a slight discussion about it, where you were doing a Van Halen mix.
Yeah, we did. We did an Atmos mix of Hot for Teacher. And Alex was here. It was actually the year anniversary of Eddie's passing. So Alex was here, and this was unbelievable. We did the mix. We had a great time, and that was it. You know, Bobby, it's tough to take a three-piece band, you know, again, and put it into 15 speakers. You know, I mean, Eddie certainly drives the bus, drums and bass, you know, so how much can you do? So, you know, where, you know, so by adding sub and some, you know, reverb and stuff and making a little larger than life. And it had some fun effects in it that we were able to kind of twist and turn. So Alex appreciated, and it was actually a very sentimental day when he was here. He was pretty teary eyed and stuff, but it was fun playing it.
You mentioned that Don Landy, the original engineer, was
there
too.
Yeah, he was here too. Yeah, he was here. He's, a legend.
Yeah.
I think they may be mixing it, one of the records. I'm not sure. I heard that possibly Dweezil Zappa was mixing it. You know, he was very close with Eddie, and I think there's a relationship there. So, but, you know, we kicked it off.
What do your clients expect from you? What are they looking for before they sign off?
You know, I think they're looking for a larger version of what they expect. You know, it's funny, we're always kind of playing the video game of the song. Anyway, I got 15 speakers here. So, I mean, you know, when you've got something in stereo, you got to work really hard to create a 3D type field in here. You know, when you've got speakers like this and nothing needs to be louder, you just give it a little bit more placement in a different place and it sounds louder. So, our clients, most of them really don't know about spatial audio. You know, the younger from the record labels, they know that it's an important thing to do. We get a lot of calls and they're, you know, we get a lot of songs and we turn them over and they're very grateful. Sometimes an artist will go and listen to something and maybe come back with a little more this, a little more that. You know, it's impossible for people to sign off on something unless they're touching a fader. So we're fine with all of that. But, we want them to be excited, you know, about hearing it in a way that they've never heard it before.
Okay, so there's, as you say, there's 15 speakers. And for instance, with a power trio, there's only so much you can do. But even with the complex mix, there's a lot of places to put things where before you had to use compression, a lot of EQ in order to find a space for everything. And now you don't have to do that because there's a lot. So do you find yourself not using as much compression or EQ or anything? Because,
you know, we analyze the tracks that come to us, theoretically mastered stems or close to what the record is like. And, you know, because this is a little bit of a different beast, you know, we do put some compression, but I treat it across all the stems. I still do like my own kind of a mastering thing where I have an EQ across everybody and a compressor across everybody. Sometimes I'll go in and individually do some things, but typically I want to do it from a global stance where we're constantly A-B-ing, here's the record, here's our mix, here's the record, here's our mix, back and forth. To see that we have, you know, the continuity of really what it is and that things are as present, you know, as the stereo mix. And then most times we beat it. most times, you know, it's easy to do. You know, you hear it, it just explodes, yeah. You know, when you open it up.
You mentioned mastering. Do you ever master or send it out to master?
This is the big part that's confusing to people because Dolby calls what they do inside their renderer, they call it mastering, you know, the mastering suite. But it's not mastering as we know it, where you take a two-track mix, send it to a mastering engineer, and he embellishes and, you know, and compresses EQs and stuff. So after an ADM is made, it's done. And I must say, it sounds fantastic going through the renderer. I mean, a lot of times we're listening in HDX and we're listening. And as soon as we're done with the mix, we go, does it sound better? Does it sound a little better? Because once we're off the HDX cards and we're through that renderer, it has that sound. It has the glue of Dolby Atmos that's in there. And it's very pleasing.
You know, it's interesting because I've talked to a number of mastering engineers that are mastering full albums, and there's not really a tool for mastering because you can't do crossfades and things like that. It's way different. So you're doing a song at a time, and that kind of eliminates some of the magic of mastering.
Yeah. You know, we have an approach to I guess mastering, for lack of a better term, when it comes to doing albums and the assembly process. It's quite tedious because you're dealing with so many automation points and all of that. But, you know, it really is a nice process to be able to get the mix across the entire project to be pretty seamless. You know, we originally, when you're going from track to track and trying to bounce from individual Pro Tool sessions, when you go to do a listening session, you know, it's pretty unequal, you know, and kind of an abrupt process. So when we started, you know, our kind of mastering assembly process all in one Pro Tool session for, you know, consecutive album, that gives a nice opportunity to really create kind of a cohesive environment that was close to, you know, that of the Stereo Masters when they did the lineup.
But only from a volume standpoint, that's not EQ.
Right.
So when we put all the tracks into an assembly session, we have a VCA master across everything so that, you know, we then go through the loudest song in the track, and then we find out, we put that at minus 18, and then everything is judged to that, you know, just like you would do.
You've had a lot of experience in this. You've listened to a lot of your own mixes, and I'm sure a lot of other people's mixes. So what makes a really good immersive mix? If you're going to put your finger on it, what makes a great mix?
No, I guess I approach things orchestrally. For me, it's blend. And I don't really want to hear something that's riveting coming out of the right rear speaker. That would be annoying to me. That would draw my ear to it and not to the lead vocal, which is the most important thing in the song, the melody of the song and where it's coming from. So I still think, though, that discrete mono recording makes for the best immersive sound, where you can have the guitar can be over up on the upper left side, and you know, you don't have its stereo counterpart somewhere else. So I go back a lot of times, you know, Dominic, and I play some of my old 5-1 mixes. I never mix from stems. I only mix from, you know, from multi-tracks, because back when we were doing 5-1, I mean, when I did Janet Jackson and Usher and Foo Fighters and all that, I mean, I got the multi-track. I had the record. I had to bounce back and forth, and I had to recreate all of the events. I never got the echo, never got stems, never got the compression. So it was the world according to me, where I, you know, bounced back and forth until it became my own. I stopped listening to the, you know, the stereo, you know, record. But I still believe that beautifully recorded mono discrete, you know, sound makes for the best immersive sound.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
You know, people ask me, about recording in Atmos. You know, it's sure, we can put up a Decca tree and all that type of stuff. But again, when you want to be able to feel something definitively in the Atmos field that's just off to the left or up to the right, and it's there by itself, there's nothing like it. It's like the planetarium of audio.
There are some mixers that use beds a lot, and there are others that say, I don't need it except to put something into the subs. How do you come down on that?
So, you know, we're pretty much of that mindset. We, you know, use the bed for the sub, and most of our stuff is objects, only because we want to guarantee, again, the placement of things. We've got some tricks that we use, you know, the bed for when we're kind of running out of gas or whatever. But, you know, mostly objects. I think some of your better mixers are doing things like that. I understand why people would put things in the bed if they've, you know, they got one computer and they're mixing on headphones and it's, you know, they don't have the gas. So, you know, learning, that's a good learning platform. But to really get into the definitive placement of things, you know, it's mostly object.
Yeah,
driven.
I think a lot of it's also driven off the, you know, the sonic differences between working in the object space and working in the bed, and its limitations and how that ends up on headphones. We spend the time in the room, but if you were going to work in the bed, you would constantly be needing to monitor what's an object and what's in the bed, and paying attention to, you know, what the spatial aspect of it, how that plays into it, what it sounds like, and
you have a lot more control. You know, in when things are in the bed as to, you know, where they are in the binaural, you know, the near, the mid, the far, you can't do that in the bed.
Yeah. Okay. Last question then, Gary. Are there any trends in immersive audio that you see? I mean, where's it going?
Well, you know, I would be remiss as a senior statesman of surround sound if I didn't mention, because I do this all the time, every time I get to speak, that there's a tremendous opportunity in our business for young engineers to learn Atmos. Old dogs like myself are not going to spend the time to go learn this. So where someone like my partner over here spent 3 months, 8 hours a day learning Atmos so that he could be useful to me, I mix, he does what he does, we mix together, we're a team. There's a tremendous opportunity for young people to learn Atmos. And in the trade-off that they can have with a mixer is they could take care of the I.O., they could take care of all the ballistics, they can make sure it gets delivered the right way, and the trade-off is they can learn how to mix from guys like you, from guys like me. So again, there is an assistant engineer opportunity. Just hired Cassie here. She's a 19-year-old girl. And she's our intern, and she's killing it now. And so, you know, we're just looking for young people that we could just train in this format, because it's very difficult to deliver it. It's very difficult to understand it. And better minds need to, you know, better younger minds need to deal with this.
You can find out more about Gary at GaryLuxMusic.com. That's Gary, G-A-R-Y, Lux, L-U-X. Gary Lux Music, all one word, .com. Also, for more with Gary, go to episode 213, where we talk extensively about his background. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOsinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOinnerCircle.com, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOwnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.